January 20th, Inauguration Day, marked 20 years since I left the White House. I love being president. And I've often said that if it weren't for term limits, I would have stayed as long as the American people would have me. But I've always thought it was a waste of time to spend your days wishing you could do something you can't do anymore. You have to find new ways to put your passions and your talents to good use. So when I was getting ready to leave office, I knew I had to look to the future and figure out what my next chapter was going to be. In 2001, I started the Clinton Foundation so that I could devote my time and energy to issues I cared about, where I thought I could make a difference, and where I could help a lot of people. Looking back over the last two decades now, these 20 years have been some of the most rewarding of my life. So why am I telling you this? Because no one should ever assume that their best, most important, most productive days are behind them. We all have the ability to keep growing and changing, learning and giving. And today I'm joined by someone whose extraordinary life has proved that as well as anyone I've ever known. I met Magic Johnson when I ran for president in 1992. And shortly after, he'd been diagnosed with HIV and retired from the NBA. I'd followed his career from his time at Michigan State through his incredible run with the Lakers. But from the time I first met him, I've been more impressed by who he is as a person than anything he'd done on the basketball court. He's built an amazing career in business and taken special pride in shattering the myth that businesses can't thrive in underserved urban communities. And he started the Magic Johnson Foundation, first to raise awareness of HIV/AIDS, then with an expanded mission to combat other challenges, including poverty and health disparities. When we first met, he told me he wanted to do as well as both an entrepreneur and an activist as he had as an athlete. He studied it, he worked at it, just as he studied basketball games and practiced for hours on end. And he had the discipline not to waste that emotional time and energy wishing he could do what he couldn't do anymore. So I'm honored to introduce NCAA champion, Olympic gold medalist, five-time NBA champion, three-time MVP, 12-time All-Star, and founder of the Magic Johnson Foundation, chairman and CEO of Magic Johnson Enterprises. My now longtime friend, Magic Johnson. Thanks for being here, Magic.
Well, thank you for having me, sir. You know I love you, and you know we've had such an incredible friendship since the first day we met. We were in Mexico together. I don't know if you remember this. Carlos Slim had his foundation event. He was giving scholarships to, I believe, 10,000 kids that day. In the evening time, he had a dinner at his house for all these people who were giving him money for his foundation. And you came up, and you were the speaker, and you gave one of the most incredible speeches, but also you were working the crowd at the same time. So I said, I'm going to steal some of that. I'm going to take some of that from President Clinton and how you always, when you had the meeting line, when everybody came up to meet you as the president or just meet you at that gala, you looked every single person in the eye and said hello to them and made them feel like they were special. And I took that from you again. You don't know that this little black boy from Lansing, Michigan, who idolized you and who watched your every move, and you made me better.
Well, thank you. Let's do just a little bit of basketball and then talk about your life since then. Tell us a little bit about growing up, how you got into basketball, and how you decided you wanted to stay and play for Michigan State.
Well, I grew up with six sisters and three brothers, so a big family. My father worked for General Motors for 30 years and won an award for never being late and never missing a day in 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so you see where I got my work ethic from. And so I'm built just like my father. I'm a worker. And so my mother worked for the school district in the school cafeteria. The one thing they stressed was education. They let me know early on, yes, we're happy that you play basketball, but if you don't get good grades, you won't be playing at all. So that kept me in the books. President Clinton, you'd be happy to know that all my sisters are teachers in the school system. And so they teach young people today in Lansing, Michigan. I'm really proud of all of them. And then I fell in love with the game, watching basketball every Saturday, every Sunday with my father. He would sit on the floor, so I would sit right next to him, and I would watch college basketball on Saturday. And then on Sunday, they made sure that we went to church as a family. And then every Sunday, no matter what was going on, I don't care how many games I had, we had to have dinner on Sunday as a family. Everybody had to be there. There's no excuses. That's why I'm a family guy today, you know. But I fell in love with the game just watching with my father. And then every time I would watch an NBA game, and at that time, Bob Cousy, Bill Russell of the Celtics, John Havlicek of the Celtics, Oscar Robertson, then, of course, when Kareem was Lew Alcindor with the Milwaukee Bucks, I would go out and I would emulate what they were doing on TV. So I would practice all their moves. And I played basketball all the time, President Clinton. I mean, it wasn't a day that I didn't play basketball. I used to shovel the snow off the ground and I would play basketball. And my mom was like, she said, that boy just loved to play basketball. And it was, and this funny thing was, in the summertime, my father also had a trash hauling service because so many mouths to feed, he had to take on a second job. And so every day in the summertime, Monday through Saturday, I would work on the truck with my father picking up people's trash. But I would say this, President Clinton, this is the greatest moment of my life, what happened to me, and this thing changed my life. So during the school year, I would get on my father's truck on Saturdays only. And so it must have been 7 below 0. And my job was to get all the loose trash around the barrels and put it on the truck. It was so cold that morning that I got half the trash and I jumped into the cabin of the truck. And you appreciate this. By the time I closed the door, my father had opened the door and grabbed me and took me back to the ice where the trash was stuck in. And he said, Irvin, if you do this job halfway, you'll do everything in your life halfway. You'll practice basketball halfway. You will study half the time. I want you to go get the shovel and break up the ice and get that trash out of there and put it on the truck. And at that moment in time, I became a perfectionist. And everything I was doing in my life, I had to do it right because my father taught me that lesson early on. That's why I am the man that I am today. I have my mother's smile and her personality and want to help everybody. And I'm just like my father. I'm a worker. I get a great joy out of working, and it's because of him. So that's my background, really, in growing up in Lansing. But the great thing, President Clinton, I took every school I went to had never won a championship. So I started in elementary. I won every single championship from the second grade all the way through the sixth grade. From the seventh grade, middle school, I won every championship, seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. Then when I got to high school, I got bused across town. So what happened was I was supposed to go to an all-black school in my neighborhood. And they were a powerhouse in the state of Michigan. And I wanted to be a part of that tradition. Busing had just came into Michigan. And I'm only a 10-minute walk from my high school I thought I was going to. Well, now I'm taking a 20-minute bus ride across town. I got there the first week or two, there was fighting every single day. So the third week, President Clinton, our principal Troop was waiting for the bus. And as the bus pulled up, he said, Irvin Johnson, come to my office. He says, there's been fighting and tension in this high school for 2 weeks. I wanted to stop. So I assembled all the black students in the gym, and Irvin, you're going to talk to them. And he had a football player who was our best football player who happened to be white. And he told him, you're going to go talk to the white students. President Clinton, I said, I just got here. I'm only 15 years old. There's juniors or seniors. Why don't you get one of them to talk to the student? He said, no, they won't listen to them, but they'll listen to you. So President Clinton, just at that moment, I didn't know I became a leader outside of basketball, right? I've always led on the basketball court, but in school or my peers, I never led them. So here I am speaking to all the students, and sure enough, we stopped fighting. I told them we had to be here, so let's make the best of it. Let's get our education. And that was the best. Not only that moment was the best thing for me, but also the 3 years going to that high school, because I learned to work with people who didn't look like me. I learned to get along with people who didn't look like me, because that was going to be my world, right? And so I'm so happy that I got bused across town and that I was able to work with people who didn't look like me and go to school with people who didn't look like me, who became my friends too. And then I led that school to its first state basketball championship at the same time. So everything just came together for me. So that's how I grew up.
Well, it's a good story, and I want people to listen to it, especially after we've just been through a few years when people act like our differences are all that matter. And the truth is that diverse groups make better decisions in every endeavor in life. I thank you for telling the story. I also want to thank you for explaining where you fell in love with basketball, watching those games with your dad, and then going out and trying to emulate what you saw. Because I followed your career from the time you were in college, and I could never figure out why in the living daylights I was looking at a guard who could shoot a skyhook. Now I know. You watched Kareem do it, didn't you? We may have unearthed a very important part of basketball history today.
Well, again, you know, he was the most dominant player at that time. So growing up, he was just a beautiful basketball player to watch. I mean, the sky hook, the footwork, the balance. Also, too, people don't realize, too, he's a smart man, too.
Oh, super smart.
I mean, he's so intelligent. And so I put it in my game, and sure enough, I shot that sky hook a number of times in the NCAA tournament. And then thank God that the Lakers came calling, and I idolized Kareem. So now I'm getting a chance to play with him. Oh, man.
We'll be right back. When you were on that dream team in 92, first, what was it like? You were at all those guys who were older than you were. And were you aware at the time of the impact you were all having across the world in making basketball maybe the world's favorite global sport? It's the only sport, really. Basketball is the only thing to seriously challenge soccer as a world sport for women and men, too.
That's right. First of all, just felt honored to represent my country, to be selected to the Dream Team. The first time pro basketball players were allowed to play in the Olympics. And then it was on my bucket list to always play with Michael Jordan and Larry Bird. And we had fought hard against each other for so many years, but now finally we're going to get a chance to play with each other. And so, President Clinton, I'm used to coming down the middle for the Los Angeles Lakers, and I got James Worthy on my right. I got Byron Scott on my left, Kurt Rambis is trailing, and then Kareem Abdul-Jabbar will come down later on. If we don't get a layup, a dunk, or a jump shot, he'll come down and shoot the skyhook. But now I have Michael Jordan on my right. Oh, man. Larry Bird is on my left. Charles Barkley is trailing. Scottie Pippen is trailing. Clyde Drexler, Chris Mullin. Man, David Robinson, Patrick Ewing. I mean, you're sitting there, John Stockton. What a team. It was so amazing. We committed to each other. And this is what changed everything. First day of practice, Chuck Daly said, President Clinton, Michael Jordan, you're going to be the captain of the Dream Team. And Michael Jordan said, no, I don't deserve to be the captain of the Dream Team. Magic Johnson and Larry Bird should be the captain of the Dream Team. So at that moment in time, that meant everybody had to leave their ego at the door, because Michael Jordan just said, hey, I'm good just being on this team, so everybody else got to be good too. So it made our job, Larry and our job, easier to lead the team, because Michael Jordan just said, hey, I'm just here. I'm going to do my job, and everybody else should do their job so we can win the gold medal. Well, we blew everybody out by over 42 points a game. It's the best basketball I was ever involved in my life. And then last but not least, it was a scrimmage. It was a game that nobody saw. That was the greatest basketball that we all ever played in our entire lives. Chuck Daly said, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to divide the team east versus the west. So Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen with the Bulls. Charles Barkley played for Philadelphia. He's over there. Larry Bird, of course, with the Celtics. Patrick Ewing was their starting center because he played for the Knicks. On our team, of course, we had all the West guys. So that meant David Robinson, Karl Malone, Chris Mullin, Clyde Drexler, and John Stockton. So he said, all right, you guys going to go head-to-head, and I want to see who's the best. President Clinton, oh, my goodness. I had never seen a group of men come together on both sides and play this game the way we played it. It was just unbelievable. You got everything that you would love in the game of basketball. If you wanted great passes, you got great passes. You wanted to see jump shots, you got that. You wanted to see defense, Patrick Ewing and David Robinson were blocking shots left and right. I mean, it was just unbelievable basketball. And everybody took it to the next level. I've seen everybody play, all these men play before, but they didn't play like that. They played to another level. If you can imagine Michael Jordan and Larry Bird going to another level, it was just unbelievable to witness and to be a part of. These are the two plays that really stood out to me. Patrick Ewing had a breakaway down the middle. He came down and he thought he was going to dunk it. David Robinson jumped straight up with two hands and blocked it. And we all went crazy, because how could he just block this shot that this man was going to tear the rim down, right? And I came down and I threw a no-look pass to Karl Malone, and he went down and almost tore the basket down. So it was a timeout, and I like to mess with Michael Jordan. So I said, MJ, if you don't turn into Air Jordan, we're going to blow you guys out. President Clinton, what did I do that for? This guy came out the next five possessions, and he hit five straight three-pointers. And then he did one of the greatest moves I've ever seen in my life. Now, he came down the right side, and David Robinson jumped, and he thought he had the block. Well, Michael Jordan just held the ball and waited till he went all the way down to the floor and looked at him as he was still in the air. And he turned and did a 360 and dunked it. And it was like, that's the greatest shot I've ever seen in my life. Who hangs in the air that long? And that's what you got out of this game, just unbelievable play after play after play. And finally, Chuck Daly, when the clock ran out, the score was tied. And Chuck Daly said, well, do you want to go into overtime? And we said, yeah, but everybody felt we were playing so hard against each other, somebody may get hurt, right? And so that ended in a tie. But let me tell you, that was the greatest basketball I've ever seen and been a part of. And those memories last forever. And look at how many players from overseas we have playing in the NBA today because of the Dream Team.
What a great story. So there you are, and then all of a sudden, it's over. When you gave up something you loved so much and did so well, did you just instantaneously remake yourself, or had you been preparing for this emotionally and psychologically a long time? Did you have a good plan?
I was preparing for life after basketball because I had two dreams in my life. I've always wanted to play in the NBA, and I also wanted to become a businessman. I met two African-American businessmen in Lansing, Michigan. I didn't know that African-Americans could own businesses. But Joe Ferguson and Greg Eaton, two gentlemen who also supported you.
Yeah, very good friend of mine.
And they showed me that we could own businesses. And I asked them one day to become my mentor, asked them for a job. They gave me my first real job. And they're still great mentors and friends of mine even today. So I was preparing for life after basketball during the time I was playing in the NBA. Dr. Jerry Buss, the owner of the Lakers, became my first mentor. And then I had guys, Michael Ovitz, Peter Gruber, all these guys became my mentors while I was still playing. And then when, in 1991, when we made the announcement that I had HIV, it devastated me. And I want to say to everybody out there, it took me a year to get over the fact that I wasn't playing the game that I loved, the game that brought so much joy and happiness to my life. The first year, it took me time to understand what I had to deal with living first with HIV. When I got the diagnosis, I remembered that HIV and AIDS at that time was a death sentence. I said, how can I be here a long time? The doctor told me three things. He said, Irvin, number one, you got to take your meds. Second, he said, you got to be okay with your new status because it's all about an attitude and a mindset now. He said, third, you got to work out. I said, now, are those the three things I have to do to be here a long time? He said, those are the three things I think you have to do. And so I tell you what really happened to me, President Clinton. I'm laying on the couch feeling sorry for myself. This is about 8-9 months in now. I'm angry. I'm upset. I'm not playing basketball. So I came into the house after working out. And my wife said, get out. And I was, what? She said, no, get out. So Cookie is telling me to get out the house. I said, get out. What are you talking about? She said, when you come back, I want you to be the man that I married. You've never been a guy who felt sorry for himself. You always looked at life, said, hey, you dealt with things that came your way and you moved on. You know, you moved on with life. You had dreams of becoming a businessman. Now it's time to go after those dreams. But you're sitting on this couch feeling sorry for yourself. And that's not you. And that's what changed my life. So I got up and started working toward becoming a businessman. I stopped thinking about trying to come back to the NBA and why I'm not playing and so on. The first thing I did was President Bush at that time asked me to join his AIDS commission. I went to Boston one day. This would really hurt me. They had a brand new hospice, 30 beds. They only had one person in that hospice. And I said, wait a minute, you got 29 beds open and we don't have people in there? They said, the certificate process is so outrageous that people can't get in. And that President Clinton, I cried. I was so upset that we had this facility to take care of people who were living with HIV and AIDS and people who needed beds, who needed rooms, and they're on the street. And so that just hurt me. And I was so happy when you became the president. And the funds that you committed also to you speaking up. And look at what happened. The results got better. The meds got better. We had more medicine. We had, now people could get jobs, and some of the discrimination stopped against people who were living with HIV and AIDS. So a lot of things changed with your leadership. And so I want to say thank you. But my wife helped me to then jumpstart my business career. And then things just opened up for me. And I did all the businesses and all the things I always wanted to do. I started the Magic Johnson Foundation. We raised millions and millions of dollars for people who were living with HIV and AIDS. Also, those who couldn't pay for their medicine, we were able to help them pay for their medicine. On and on and on. So especially in the Black community, because it was running rapid through the Black and brown community. So I had to educate my people about this disease and what it was doing to our community. So again, it was just that time I got into business, but also was committed. And then last but not least, I got to say something about Elizabeth Glazier, who was dying of AIDS at that time. And you remember, she allowed Cookie and I to go visit her. And she said, I want you to become the face of this disease because we need a face. We don't have a face. And I committed to her when she was dying that I would do that. And sure enough, it'll be 30 years this November that I'm living with HIV. And so she changed my life. She changed my wife's life. I'm so happy to still be in the fight. And I'm so happy about the Magic Johnson Foundation and also the Clinton Foundation and all the things you're doing. And people don't know all the things you're doing, not just here in America, but around the world, President Clinton. And your foundation has touched so many people. So thank you for what you've been doing. So because that's important.
Stay tuned for more of the conversation after this short break. Let's talk just a little bit before we run out of time here. What's the first successful business you owned? What was your first success?
The first success, I would say, was a radio station. That was my first thing. Minorities were allowed at that time to buy TV stations, radio stations at a cheaper price. And so I bought radio stations and then resold them. I changed them from an AM to an FM, which an FM more expensive. So it worked out great for me. And I brought a bunch of basketball players in with me, and they all made money. They thought I was their hero then, right? So, but I would say the biggest thing I ever done in the beginning, though, to prove myself to have a track record of success was Starbucks, taking Starbucks. And you and I, people don't realize how aligned you and I are and how friends we are. This is really incredible. It's two people on this earth who changed Harlem, and we're both on this Zoom call today. First, when I put the Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem and I brought Starbucks to Harlem, that changed Harlem. Then this president, what's his name? President Clinton put his office right by my Starbucks. That changed Harlem. So both of us are responsible for what's going on today. Now they have so many new restaurants. You see people eating outside in Harlem that never happened before. New development is going up in Harlem, hotels, things of that nature. So we created a lot of job opportunities in Harlem, but also places for people to go. That was my first big deal, was building 125 Starbucks in 40 different cities across the country. And Howard Schultz, I owe him a lot because we came together and did some powerful and great things in the inner cities of America by bringing Starbucks to the urban communities.
Why'd you buy a WNBA team?
Oh, I love women's basketball. And even today, I watch college women's games all the time. And then when you think about the WNBA and owning the LA Sparks, I was going to the games already. And so when the team came up for sale, my partners and I, who owned the Dodgers together, we just said, hey, why don't we just buy the team? Because we all love the WNBA. We love women's sports. So we decided to buy the team. And it's been great owning the team. Candace Parker, who is one of the greatest players of all time to play in college basketball and the WNBA, we're led by her. And so, President Clinton, I've had some year. When I think about the Lakers winning the championship, and they dedicated the year to Kobe Bryant, of course, with him passing away. And they end up winning the championship. And then my Dodgers end up winning the World Series. So it's been some year for me in terms of sports. And that's why I bought them, because I just wanted to keep the LA Sparks in Los Angeles. And my wife and I enjoy. And then one day, we can pass it on to our daughter, who also played high school basketball herself.
Well, the one thing I want to do, I know we got to wrap this up and you've got something else to do, but I don't think most people know just how much you have done since this COVID problem, whacked us, to save minority and women-owned businesses. I think it turned out to be your opportunity, because you saw it as an opportunity and an obligation to do something to advance racial justice and economic justice, as well as to lend a helping hand to small businesses who don't have the access to capital that you do. So just talk about what you did through your insurance company and to help businesses, minority and women-owned businesses, after COVID, because it's been a big problem all across the country that a lot of bigger businesses did fine and could access this government program, and some of the people that needed it the most couldn't get it, and you stepped in to the breach. And I think it may be 20 years from now one of the most significant things you ever did in your life, and I want a record of it.
So the first thing we were able to do was commit a couple hundred million. The money went so fast because so many businesses needed help that then we put up another $125 million, brought the total to $325 million. And we were able to save tens of thousands of businesses and also save them from also firing or letting go of their employees as well. I'm so happy that I was in a position, God blessed me to be in this position to help. I've always been about trying to uplift the Black community and the Latino community any way I can. And so I just felt at that time it was a need, and I could be a solution to those small Black business owners and Latino business owners and women own businesses as well. So it's been a blessing for them and a blessing for me too at the same time.
As we close, I want to say again how much you have meant to all three of us and our small family, a shining light and a constant reminder to never give up, keep your chin up and keep going. But now all over America, people are beginning to wonder, well, when is this ever going to be over? And when it's over, will it ever be like it was? And if it's not going to be like it was, is it going to be good? How do you think about that? What would you say to people about how to stay with the program right now so we don't have a lot more people die, And then how do you think about the future?
I'm a positive guy. I've always been that. And I think that we'll be heading in the right direction as a country. And I think people need to just hold on. Help is on the way. When you think about this pandemic and what's going on there, I think that, you know, we get our shots and do what we're supposed to do and wear our mask and stay safe and healthy, I think, and protect not only yourself, but other people will be fine there. But I think the economy will turn around. And I think that hopefully in the next, whether it's this year or in 2022, we'll be back to heading in the right direction and back strong again as a nation. And I think the economy will be strong as well. So I'm looking forward to that. And I hope to be a part of that solution as well. Just like I work with you, just like I work with President Obama, I want to make sure I work with President Biden as well and just make things better for our country, but also those who live in urban America. That's always been my focus and it will always be my focus.
Well, we just heard a remarkable person. My life has been blessed by his friendship and by the example he set. We love you, man. Thank you so much.
I love you, and thank you for having
me. I miss you. I'll see you. Thank you. Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Chris Thrasher, and I serve as the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery with the Opioid Response Network at the Clinton Foundation. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, each year we lose tens of thousands of lives to an opioid overdose in the United States. And now with COVID-19, this tragic and preventable epidemic has only worsened and intensified. At the Clinton Foundation, we're working to combat this crisis head-on. We invite you to learn more about our work and see how you can get involved. Please visit us at clintonfoundation.org/podcast.